Good morning. I heard that one time in the old days in China, a Zen practitioner named Zhao Zhou came to another Zen practitioner, Nan Chuan, and asked, "What is the way? What is the Tao which by this time in China, the Buddha Dharma and the Tao Dharma had intermingled. So this word Tao, that for many centuries in China had meant like the way things are beyond human conventions, this term had mixed with the Buddhist term enlightenment or awakening. So what is awakening? What is the way? And Nan Chuan said, "Ordinary mind is the way." And this term, ordinary mind, heijoushin, Japanese, also implies literally could be translated as continuous or permanent mind. Jo means like permanent. So kind of a double meaning. Colloquially means ordinary everyday mind, but also the continuous mind that runs through every day and all experience. Ordinary continuous mind is the way. And Zhao Zhou asks, "Well, how can I direct my attention towards this mind? If it's the way, wouldn't that be the thing to do?" And Nan Chuan says, "If you direct your mind towards it, the way you direct your mind towards all the other objects of your experience, you go astray from it." Oh, shucks. If this is the way, this is like the most precious reality ever, we want to know it. How can we direct the mind to it? If we direct the mind in the way we usually direct the mind to know some object, then we go astray from it. And then Nan Chuan asks, "Well, if I don't direct my attention towards it, then how can I know it's the way? What amazingly wonderful questions, I feel. If I don't direct my attention towards it, then how can I know that it's the way?" And Zhao Zhou says, "The way is not a matter of knowing or not knowing. Knowing the way we usually know objects of experience is like a basic delusion, actually. It's dividing undivided reality into a knower and a known. So knowing is delusion, but not knowing is just like a blank nothingness. That's like just also ignorance, right? Not knowing, just like duh. So knowing is basic delusion of dividing reality into a knower and a known, and not knowing is blankness or nothingness. Jiao Zhou says, and then he goes on to say, when we truly are the way, it's like vast empty space. How could ideas like existence and non-existence even apply here? And at these words, Jiao Zhou awoke to the way. Any questions?
It's all Greek to me.
Yeah, I think it's two different kinds of ignorance, we could say. The, you know, dualistic mind that knows objects as external to itself is a kind of root ignorance that's like the root of like fear, attachment, aversion, all types of suffering arise from this kind of knowing, actually. And then this kind of knowing, of a subject knowing an object, and then not knowing is the blankness, is another kind of ignorance, I think we could say, almost like there's no life, there's, you know, not knowing at all. I think he means in this case, blanking out. Turning off the mind, we might think of like as death or something. I mean, how is that, how could that be the way? To realize the way, would we have to have like a frontal lobotomy or something? So that kind of not knowing.
There's another koan where not knowing is most intimate.
Yeah, and there's other stories where knowing is also a kind of knowing without touching things is most intimate. So both these words can have, but this kind of dualistic knowing is not the way, and a completely blank not knowing is the way. And I think that not knowing is most intimate. We have that story. Not knowing is most intimate. In this case, seems to mean not knowing things as separate objects, and also the knowing, one of our Zen ancestors says, Zazen is knowing without touching things. And I think this is also the same as not knowing is most intimate. Knowing without touching things is ordinary mind that doesn't meet objects, things, separate from itself.
Doesn't that go back to when the time, not things,
the myriad things come forth?
Yeah, going forth to meet things is delusion, things coming forth and meeting or being is most whatever.
Yeah. That Dogen says, to carry the self forward and experience the myriad things is delusion, which is what we're, this kind of knowing, the knowing that reaches out to touch the myriad things is delusion. Myriad things coming forth and confirming or realizing the self is awakening.
What about intention? Does that allow you to approach the way?
That's a great question, I think, because that was the Jiaozhou's first question: how can I direct the attention or the mind towards the way? Which is, directing is kind of like intention. Directing the mind towards one thing or another is we could say that's what intention is. So intention does seem necessary, actually, seems to me, to realize the way, because if we just kind of sit here and like, okay, way, come and show yourself to me, I'm just kind of waiting for something to dawn on me, it's kind of a passive, and there's like, I'm not going to put any intention into this because that would be delusion, then I think we could wait forever. So there is an intention.
Is there the intention to study delusion or squeezing out its emptiness?
I think that would be one intention, yeah. The intention to look directly at delusion and see what it really is could be one intention. And another intention could be like to ask, like, what is ordinary mind, the way, what is the way as ordinary mind, but without directing the attention towards it as an object. That's what I think that Nan Chuan was pointing to. If you direct, you know, let's get to work here now. How can I direct my attention towards it? Just tell me where to direct it. and the way we usually direct the mind towards something, and maybe Jiaozhou and Nan Chuan felt that this is too much like trying to do something. So if you direct your mind towards it, to know it as we usually know things, that won't work because it's not an object. Ordinary mind. Letting things arrive, and the intention to let things arrive?
I think it's just more of my understanding would be like to observe it and to respond to it. And that response is the kind of intention part, but it's kind of sticky there, that part. I kind of feel like, I kind of understand the idea of directing objects and having a certain intention or expectation or
So a little bit like if going to this Dogen, saying the intention to not carry myself forward and rule my day, maybe control my day, but actually that's kind of an intention to, I'm starting to do that, the intention to just let go of that impulse to carry the self forward and experience something, and therefore the intention to let the myriad things come forth and arrive outside of my control. The intention to let go of personal control, which is kind of, maybe that's kind of sticky, because intention usually does seem like the root of personal control. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. So it's like an intention to not direct myself, we could say, yeah.
Perhaps you
could say it's the intention to experience things as they are.
Yeah. And what is it that, what is things as they are? You might say, like, not adding anything extra to them. But
not trying to impose change, perhaps.
Yeah. Not trying to manipulate things. In this story, it seems like the pointing is back to the ordinary mind as the way. It's kind of like every time that non-Tuan is asking about, even trying to find this mind, he's kind of trying to make it into some object, like one of the myriad things to know. And so in this story, it's like we're not even looking at how things are. We're more like looking back at the ordinary mind that knows the things, and that will give us a clue to what things are, things as they are, what that is. If we look to the things to know what they are as they are, we may not be able to really see what they are. This is sort of counterintuitive. Well, if we want to see things as they are, shouldn't we look at the things and investigate them? But this is more like we're looking back at the ordinary mind, that the continuous awareness that knows things. And from that perspective, now as the ordinary mind that Jiaozhou says is like empty space, when being that mind, then we can now look back at all the things as they are, and now is like a different relationship to the things. Richard.
As the comments come, then they start to fill in the points to make, synthesizing a little bit, I think the idea of moving the self forward is the idea of having judgment or having an idea or having concepts or having, assumptions about things. Taking those away and abiding in a quiet place with extreme awareness that includes using all the senses and everything that is composed of this being to allow us to experience the world around us without projecting on it is I think a way of being, and maybe it's, and it has to do with the headless impression, where we're not, the head is just the head, it sees and hears, and it's part of this being, but it's not there to project and to judge and to already name. The other way is the way as Gene was talking in his picture of how you would describe that model he had of knowing and being, was to take the world and sense the world in a headless way from intuition. And that intuition is silent listening. That allows us to know in a way other than conceptually. In my head, that's accessible way instead of a fancy way of saying not going forward and meeting, the world, but
Yeah, so when we're just super aware, like you said, and we're noticing the tendency to maybe judge things or project stories onto things. Is that what you mean by projections?
Absolutely.
So yeah, there's that, and then we might, if we're doing that, we can look more and more closely and see that actually the things that we're now not projecting onto, could it be that those things, so-called things, themselves are actually projections of this awareness? Not just like there's an because still, if we're, there's an awareness aware of things, we're just not going to mess with those things. Is a great practice, but if we get into that practice. Not messing with the things, this really cooled out awareness, watching them without manipulating, then we might start to see how those very things still seem to be separate from this awareness or this headless head or something. Don't they seem that way? Like, even when we're not manipulating them, like there's a chair here, I'm just totally letting it be the chair. I'm not like adding it, subtracting anything. I have no judgments or assessments about this chair. It's just simply what it is. But then in that calm, aware space, if I ask, well, does it still seem to be like a chair over there? Yeah, actually it does. Because we're still looking at the object. So, if we come to rest as the ordinary mind itself, that's boundless, like empty space, and then look look around as this mind. Start examining its qualities, like, well, is it really boundless? Yeah, it doesn't seem to have any edges. And I think this is the key point here, one of the key points, is if it's boundless, means we can't find the edges of this awareness, then that means the awareness doesn't stop at the edge of the chair. If it did, then its boundary would be right there. Does that make sense? So actually, if it's boundless, like space, then the chair is almost like included in this big space called awareness. See how that's like a little bit different?
How do you know where to sit in the chair?
Because we're so used to doing that. It's like in a dream, because this is a little bit, if we start looking that way, things seem to start to seem a little bit more dreamlike. And if we compare it to an actual, like, sleeping dream, it's like, it's really like completely mind-made world. But in the dream, we know, if we see a chair, we know how to sit down in the chair very easily, right? Even though it's not really happening that way. Just because we've sat in many chairs, we've done this seeming thing of sitting in chairs for so long.
Understanding the boundlessness and then just still seeing it for what it is in the relative world. You know what I mean? Like, you know, the mountain's a mountain, mountain's not a mountain, mountain's a mountain.
In this boundless space, again, we're just in our experience when we're looking at the boundless space of awareness, is it like nothing's there? No, I mean, we're just talking about this ordinary awareness. It's not some special other awareness. This awareness right now, when we start examining the edges of it, just experientially, it seems, I mean, what do you think? Does it seem like you can find any edges or boundaries to it? This awareness. But then are there things like chairs and people appearing in this awareness? Of course, right? We could call that the relative world, is everything that appears in this vast field, space-like field of awareness. But now these things that are appearing in awareness, again, in our direct experience, is there any way to confirm that these things are somehow outside of the awareness or separate from it, from the point of view of our actual experience? Yeah, it doesn't seem like it, does it? Even though we're completely trained since birth to think of them as being actually outside of awareness. I mean, that's how we relate to them. There's awareness here that's knowing this thing over here. But if we're really calm, quiet, in this spacious awareness, then we can start to examine what are objects, and it's very hard not to fall back into our usual way of thinking that we've been doing since we were born, of, well, objects are like something a little bit outside the awareness that the awareness knows. But we can't actually, it seems to me, if we start looking at our experience, really investigating it, putting aside all our usual ideas, just in the direct experience, what are these objects in relation to the awareness? Does that make sense? Yeah.
What helps me is what we were talking about this last week, like the cloud in the paper or the tree, where it came from, and in a few centuries, it and we will be something else.
We could think that way, yeah, but I think I would say... Yeah, I think that could remind us of important points about it. But the problem with that is that it's like a conceptual story that we're telling. The nice thing about this is, like, you could say this is a conceptual story that I'm telling, but I'm trying to come into this investigation that's not based on any, like, stories involving time or, you know, what happened, even impermanence, like the fact that the chair is going to change, or just right now, this chair, whether it's impermanent or not, in the resting as this awareness itself, looking at objects, you know, material or sound or smell or taste or physical.
It's still a mental process of naming. It's still a mental process of naming and basically separating.
Yeah, there's a naming things, and then when we name them, we usually think of them as separate. But it may be that in the space of awareness, we can even use the name, like, well, yeah, we call this a chair. It's part of awareness that we call a chair. It's like awareness is appearing as a visual form and a tactile sensation that we put these together and call it chair. And of course, we're still going to call it chair. And it's, how do we do that? Well, it's very easy because we've been doing it forever. But now, our relationship to it doesn't become even more like hazy or more clear or anything. It's like the appearance is exactly the same, but the relationship to it is now like shifting a little bit. Doesn't it seem? If this chair is like almost like made out of this awareness, it's like we use these images like, the awareness is like the mirror, and the chair's a reflection on the mirror. Means like it's not actually 2 feet away from me. Like another thing to investigate here is near and far, from, because if we confirm that awareness is boundless, means it has no edges or dimensions at all. Literally, like it's not like it's a million miles and then it has edges. Boundless means it has no dimension in space at all. We say in the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, which I think is talking about ordinary mind, so vast, it so minute, how does it go? So vast it transcends dimension, so small it fits into spacelessness. In its greatness, it is utterly beyond location. In its fineness, it fits into spacelessness. Is that how it goes?
Yeah, that's close enough.
Yeah. Yeah, but this point is about the spatial dimensionality of the dual mirror samadhi. So vast, it transcends dimension, or, you know, size. So small, it fits into spacelessness. In other words, it's not like boundlessness means really, really big. Sometimes we might call it big mind, but not big as opposed to small. It has no size. How could awareness have size, right? So in this sizeless realm, what is near and far? Like, is Stan further away than this chair if I'm just being the awareness? No. Right? Can you see that point? Yeah. And really, like, not like an idea of this, right? But if you're actually resting as the awareness and looking from the point of view of the awareness. And I think the only hard part is putting aside our usual idea of course Stan is further away than the chair, because that's how we usually see. Yeah? So if we say Stan and the chair are neither one's closer than the other, because they're not something outside of awareness. They do appear to be outside of awareness, for sure.
Awareness is all-inclusive.
It's all-inclusive. It's all-inclusive. Nothing could ever be apart from it. And that's non-duality. Yes. Yes.
Back to intention.
Yes.
Could we not think of it as arising from the invitation of a myriad things to acknowledge non-separation?
Like inviting the myriad things?
No, the myriad things inviting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the intention arising to mm-hmm. acknowledge.
Almost like the myriad things create my intention, would you say? The myriad things invites this person's intention.
Mm-hmm. To acknowledge the non-separation.
Yeah! I think that's how, but if we look at where does the intention come from, not really me, right? There's no personal independent self that creates an intention. So we could say the intention dependently arises, which is another, a beautiful way you said that, is the myriad things come forth and give rise to an intention, or invite an intention to be aware, for example. So we might say, like, well, we're going through our day in our usual deluded, separated kind of way, and then suddenly we kind of like remember walking down the street, and suddenly like, wait a second, where's ordinary mind right now? You know, that happens sometimes, right? And then it's like nothing really changes, of course, but it's a shift of perception, would we say? It's not even exactly a shift of perception. It's more just like looking from a different perspective. And then it's more like now it's not that I'm walking down the street. Now it's like there's ordinary mind in which the street is coming towards us as we're walking, right? The ordinary mind is not changing. It's now the street and the people and all the things are appearing in the space of ordinary mind. And how did that sudden remembering happen? We could say it's very mysterious. But we could say that's the myriad things come forth and invite. We could also call it, in Zen we talk about kano doko, which means like the mystical communion of like Buddhas and sentient beings. Mm-hmm. So we're a sentient being means like a dualistic mind. That's one definition of a sentient being. We're a dualistic mind walking down the street, thinking I'm walking down the street and I'm traveling this way. And then that sentient being called this dualistic mind meets Buddha, our own. Buddha's, and another word for Buddha is ordinary mind. And so, like, our dualistic mind suddenly, like, somehow gets in contact with ordinary mind, and then this like, different point of view arises. And now the street is coming forth and decorating the space we call ordinary mind.
Question. From that ordinary mind, every moment of our lives, responding compassionately, with awareness and compassion, is that, how does that fit appropriately with compassion? How does that fit?
Yeah.
In terms of how we then not just are aware of the world, but respond to it with heart.
Mm-hmm. Because usually what blocks compassion,
yes,
is the belief that other beings are separate, yeah, or outside of this awareness.
So responding compassionately is our natural...
Ordinary mind is naturally... doesn't block anything. As you said, everything's included. So all beings are included. Suffering beings are included. Sometimes I think of it as like, there's two different parts here. Like there's harmlessness. So I think in the space of ordinary mind where everything's included, there's no reason to harm anything. Like if this chair is part of awareness, it's a reflection on the mirror, it's a decoration. It's another image is like awareness is like water, and the objects that appear in it are like ice. Like, so they're actually made out of water, but they're frozen, means like they seem to be,
for now
they seem to be fixed. Or like congealed, they're not free flowing like the awareness itself is, but they actually are. And then as we start to look at them that way, they start to melt. And then, the more water melts, we know when we have ice in water, the more the ice melts, more quickly the water starts to melt the ice, right? Until there's just a little bit of ice and it really quickly melts. At first, it seems like the whole world is frozen ice, and there's a little tiny bit of recognition of ordinary mind, but it starts to melt it a little bit, and then the more and more are this ocean of water of ordinary mind, now there's just a little, like, bits of ice, maybe less and less things are contracted. And then, but in the space where everything is included, then it doesn't make sense to harm something that's part of awareness. It's more like, then we're falling for it as being something that, like, you could also say harm always comes from trying to get something for myself at the expense of others. It's another, or in all kinds of ways, yeah. Killing is kind of taking what's not given to, right? And speaking harshly is kind of like, it's usually to diminish something that seems to be out there. All these precepts, they're all, all the precepts of non-harm are based on looking at this illusion that things are outside ourself, and we need to somehow harm others to get something for ourselves. If from the point of view of this awareness, there's nothing left to get for ourselves because it's all me in a way, big me. There's nothing apart from this awareness that would, even if there's really like awful images on the mirror embraces them all equally. So in that way, there's no harm. So that's one part, but then compassion, I think harmlessness and compassion seem to be slightly different. Compassion almost seems like it's not just not harming because there's no reason to harm. It's a little bit more active, right? It's a little bit more like, now I see that in this space of awareness, everybody is nothing but this space of awareness, but we all, yeah, including me a lot of the time, and everybody else a lot of the time, most of the time, don't see it from this perspective. We see me separate from objects, and because of that we suffer. That's the root of suffering. So we're all caught in this basic illusion that causes so much pain and confusion, right? So we see, we could say this is what it means to like see the Buddha nature of all beings. We see that, we know, we don't exactly see it, we know from our own experience this awareness must be the case. There's nothing special about me. All beings, all sentient beings are this awareness, right? And we all misinterpret this. And suffer. Therefore, compassion seems like this wish to free these other awarenesses from this illusion that causes so much suffering. And, you know, it doesn't mean necessarily just trying to awaken beings to awareness. It means also if they're really... yeah, if they're hungry, you might say, well, the root illusion is the separation. But if you're hungry, actually feed them. That's the most appropriate thing first.
I like what you said about, like, letting the myriad things invite your attention, invite your response. And that action in itself feels like to me it's like compassion. It's just responding, you know, without self-interest, just responding to that situation. So being, you know, letting the myriad things invite your attention brings compassion.
Yeah, that is part of it. That there's that, and then there's looking at this whole process from the point of view of ordinary mind is adds another dimension to it too, because we say like is this myriad things coming forth and confirming the self, is that the same as ordinary mind? In a way, yeah, but in, I think they're different ways of looking at it though, also. One of them's like, even if it's like, I'm just responding, does it still seem like there's somebody responding to somebody else? If it does, then that's still great, but it's still somewhat caught by this illusion.
There's like, sometimes if I'm, a situation arises, and I'll respond without thinking much about it.
Uh-huh.
I just want to take care of
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
That, you know,
uh-huh.
Taught,
yeah.
Then I'm
separate.
But if I respond, you know, I'm almost automatically, you know, more like I'm not doing that. Whereas if I give it some thought,
yeah.
No, I don't really want to
yeah.
do this right now.
Yeah. But even then though, I think this is an interesting question to look at. Even when we just immediately respond, everything goes so well, it's just without adding any extra thinking, there's just a natural response and it works out great, and still we can examine at the time or afterwards, did it still seem like there was somebody responding to somebody else? I think that's the maybe more subtle point. I mean, even without this subtle point, we can still do a lot of spontaneous, non-conceptually elaborated response. But it might be getting closer and closer. I think it is getting closer and closer, because conceptuality is what creates the whole delusion. So if it's not an immediate, uncontrived response, it is getting closer, I think, but to the ordinary mind of which, outside of which there is nothing. But it might not necessarily be that. Does that make sense? Oh, those could be slightly different.
Could be, but there's the planet turning towards the sun, which starts to say, yes, there can be a really organic and spontaneous response that comes from ordinary mind. Where without thinking or judging, there's a question of harmony. There's a question of natural give and take. You know, I don't think a plant thinks about it. I think it does. It does something because that's the order.
Yeah. Well, I don't. Yeah. Plants is gets like brings up lots of sticky questions
because we. Not so much.
Because we really can't project whether a plant has mind or not.
Wouldn't matter.
Is there something wrong with like a situation? You have two things going on at one time, or one thing going on, and somebody else says something to you, and they ask you something, and you make a choice. Maybe I make that choice because I want it. What's more important? So it's that judgment, or what's more helpful, or whatever. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with that? Because it's still kind of like the plant going to the sun, so to speak. I'm still trying to respond in a bodhisattva way.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, this is just like positive intention, compassion, appropriate response.
But is there a use for discrimination? Is what I'm trying to say. Is there, it's a word, but like it gets complicated. You can't go around just saying yes all the time. I don't know. Even maybe you can.
No, there's not, it's not about yes or no. You say, what's wrong? There's nothing wrong with just always trying to respond compassionately and putting our limited self out of the way. But again, I'd say there's still this other point of like duality, which is what I think this particular story is pointing to. It's like, that within this big space of awareness, there's the appearing on the mirror, there's kind actions, there's unkind actions, and in accord with precepts and not in accord with the precepts, all of this is happening, but it's all happening as like modulations of this awareness. And then I think, there is a relationship between resting as this awareness and how does the response become more appropriate in the dream world when resting as the awareness? Yes, I think if not, then there's not really any point. It does seem to evolve, but now it's not evolving based on like I'm trying to do the right thing.
You're being done by the right thing.
It's more like. It's more like there's nothing apart from me.
No. Bernie Glassman talks about all that being necessary is to sit in the situation and then the appropriate response arises naturally. That seems to suggest that in addition to sort of the awareness that there's a mechanism sort of, that the situation is it is, and when there's awareness, then there's sort of a natural order or mechanism or something that will choose that will dictate what the appropriate thing is.
Yeah, we might even say when everything is part of the big ocean of ordinary mind, then the way the conventional appearances play out naturally becomes more and more in accord with the reality we call ordinary mind. Usually the conventional appearances might seem out of accord with the kind of one mind. But when being the one mind, it's like the appearance, to have the appearances kind of act out of the illusion of separation doesn't make sense anymore. So they naturally come into accord with the reality of non-separation. Naturally, not because like, wouldn't this be good if these both accorded now? It's like, not like that. It's more like, there's nothing to make it out of accord. Maybe that's the point. There's nothing to make the action inappropriate. But usually there's a lot to make the action inappropriate, like which is the belief in the separation. So it's just removing the obscuration of this belief or view, and then naturally the dream world comes into accord. Yes.
I'd like to talk about awareness as whole being awareness. It seems like maybe we're just thinking of mental awareness.
Yeah, it's not merely mental,
no,
actually.
And to recognize the body's awareness of the situation, too, by what the body's experiencing. Like, you know, oh, there's suffering happening here. What's the body saying? Where is it closing down?
Yeah.
Or is it opening up and the impulse to relieve the suffering just spontaneously happens? I think it's just a real a guide or a, I can't think of the word I want, but to be aware of those.
Like it's a teacher even, the body awareness.
Right, but it's an ongoing clue to what your awareness, to what your mental awareness is doing too. Because there's always the body who's
working. Yeah.
Always the body who's working. Bypasses the
mind. Mm-hmm. So one thing is this awareness, this ordinary mind we're talking about, even though it's sometimes called ordinary mind, is, I say, it's not the mind. It's not the mind we usually think of that knows objects. And it's not the body. And it's not anything else. It's like, that's why Dogen says, awakening is dropping off body and mind. Even mind, this ordinary awareness is not, also not mind. Mind meaning like the mind that knows things. That drops off, or that drops off means drops off as a separate thing. Now dualistic mind is kind of like functioning within this awareness, and body, which is basically like these tactile sensations. That's how awareness knows the body, as a tactile sensation. And seems like, from the point of view of awareness. And that tactile sensation is, that's appearing in the field of awareness is, gives us clues about how this, the world functions. And, it almost like it gives clues to the big awareness, which is not mind, and it's not like located up here, although we tend to think it's around the brain or the sense organs, but actually it's boundless and has no location, this awareness. So yeah, it includes mind and the senses, and it includes the body. And the body is like another sense, actually, right? From the point of view of awareness. It's a sensory organ in a way that's showing us information. Yeah, that the body naturally does stuff like the fact that if in ordinary or in dualistic mind, when a dog starts suddenly growling and jumping out at us, the body naturally, the heart starts beating faster. It's like who's doing that, right? That's kind of like the plant image. Like that's just a not totally natural, unintentional response to get the body ready to move quickly if there's a danger. for example. And then compassion in the body, yeah, we feel like an ache in the heart, maybe if we see others suffering as a physical response. And that's because again, I think that's more like part of the wiring of this of the appearing world. The appearing, if it, we call it a dream world, but it's not like it's just randomly, like dreams, like anything could suddenly shift. In our waking dream world, it's like the laws of cause and effect cannot be denied, right? And how suffering of others affects this person and so on. All of this stuff is highly predictable, and it's flexible, but it's like almost like the miracle of the apparent world is it follows these laws. And I think part, which is amazing, but also part of the tricky thing that it follows these laws, is that then it convinces us that of this illusion that it's really real. Like whenever I, you know, come into the Zendo, the altar is right there, you know, because this is just laws of cause and effect in the appearing world. It's not really that there's an altar kind of separate from the awareness, but since it always follows that those laws, we then believe that it's actually not a part of the boundless awareness, but we think it's an object separate. Don't we? I think this is part of like the grand illusion of the appearing world, is it's so convincing. There's all these pieces of it that keep convincing us that that it can't, that Kokyo's crazy story like this couldn't really be true, even though it's an interesting story. And the end of the day, when I go home, I don't really, like, believe it. I don't believe it a lot of the time, most of the time. But in fact, when I really come to rest as this awareness, and one day sitting is great for this, because there's nothing else to do all day. We have to do so be this awareness. And then, so getting really used to it. Am I aware? Is there awareness right now? Yes, this very awareness. How do I know I'm aware? Awareness knows it's aware. Now I'm like already not relating to objects just by asking these simple questions. Now I'm not relating to objects in the usual way. It's hard to stay with that because a little sound comes in and the mind goes zip out to the object again. Is there awareness? Yes. And then the more we can rest in it, the more then we can start to explore. I think just recognizing awareness itself is not that big a deal. It's different. It's definitely different than our usual object-directed attention. But I think the implications, which means like investigation, you could say it's a kind of calm abiding in a way to just rest as the awareness. But then if we're somewhat used to resting here, we can start looking around and asking these questions. And I think the most important question, or first ask, like, does it have any boundaries? I think is it in the experience of awareness? Not because what I heard, it shouldn't have any, but like, does it in this experience? And then start investigating the objects. Visuals may be kind of nice. You know, open the eyes during zazen as the awareness and start looking. Is the wall or the floor, how far is it from this awareness? One could ask that question over and over again and keep looking in the direct experience. How far away is that wall? Well, it's 3 feet. No, that's just what I'm trained to see. And then if we get used to asking those questions, then a different world, or a different relationship to the world starts to open up, doesn't it? And then other things we could ask at this time are, you know, what about compassion? Is how does my when I think about some other person in this room or on the other side of the world as this awareness, how does it feel? Yeah, we can.
Or how do I perceive what they feel?
Mm-hmm. And are they, if this awareness is boundless, is that person actually part of this awareness? Mm-hmm. And therefore, how do I now relate to them as part of this awareness? And it, not fall, also we've got to be careful not to fall into this awareness is me, and everything now is me. That's like solipsism, right? It's not, it's almost kind of close to that, but it's also that we know that if this body and mind has this awareness, we pretty much can know when we look at another person, it's the same, they have the same experience of boundless awareness. Now how does boundlessness meet boundlessness? This is where it gets kind of weird. And without getting too conceptual about trying to figure it out, just look at another person who has boundless awareness and this boundless awareness, and this is another question now we could ask is, where does this apparent person's awareness meet that apparent person's awareness? If they're both boundless and have no edges, where do we meet? And if this body is not far or near in this awareness, and that body's not far or near, is it like the bodies are these images on one mirror? And Zen talks about this. Other schools of Buddhism don't say this so much. They might, but I think this is part of the Zen thing of Huangbo in particular. It says all Buddhas and all sentient beings are just this one mind. When I first heard that, I thought, that's kind of a fun thing to say, but like, he doesn't really mean that. Does he? But I kind of like, exploring this awareness, I think it's a brilliant thing to say, because how can we find a separation in experientially between this mind and that mind? You could say, this person has their whole karmic history, that kind of mind. Karmic mind is different. I have different karmic background, and so I respond differently than another person. That kind of mind is appearances on the mirror. But the mirror, there's not like two different mirrors bumping into each other, because then they'd have edges. One vast ocean with little blocks of ice called sentient beings floating around in it. And the sentient beings... the path is to melt all sentient beings into the ocean. And then, do they not appear as sentient beings? And is it just like a field of light or something? I don't know. I think it's like there can still be like more and more watery appearances of sentient beings. They're just like unfrozen. But they still, these laws of cause and effect play out. Even in sleeping dreams, right? There's still, we might be able, I can fly, but there's still like a sky and a body. Even the laws of basic structure of the universe still operate even in the sleeping dream. Well, anyway. Anything else? Yeah, very practical. Mm-hmm.
It's just awareness.
Uh-huh.
How far is that?
Yeah. And we look out at the room. Where is there any near and far in this awareness? And now, it is a little bit different, isn't it? If you start looking at it like that. And that's just visual. That's just of the visual field. So we might say, well, this is just a trick of the eye organ or something. But we're not just talking about visual awareness, right? So then the other senses. I hear this music in the park. I'm saying it's in the park, but is it really in the park? How far away is that music? From awareness. It's not even say it's like really, like awareness is, if we say awareness is located like in the ear or in the head or something, then it's right here, but it's not located. It all breaks down. It's not near. Or it's definitely not far, but it's also not near. It has no location. None of the stuff has any location because it's all appearing in awareness, and awareness has no location. Does that make sense? And yeah, so the colors and shapes, the sounds, the smells of incense or whatever, the tastes of lunch, the tactile sensations is a really good one in a one-day sitting, because there will be tactile sensations throughout the day. Sometimes uncomfortable, like my knee really hurts now. So this is a great practice when your knees hurt. There is just this one awareness. Now, where is this tactile sensation called knee pain in terms of the awareness? Oh, it's down here in the knee. No, that's my idea.
It's your ligament tearing.
We want to take care of ourselves too, right?
Just kidding.
Yeah. But, you know, basic discomfort or comfort, like, I feel so light and blissful now. Where's that blissful feeling? Where the body itself, so this is, I think, an interesting one. What is the body in terms of this boundless awareness? Especially if we close our eyes, it's like this field of tactile sensation. And even to think, it's mostly down here. This is the locationality thing again. My first sense of the body is, it's down here. I think that's a conceptual idea. From the point of view of awareness, has no location. We're not talking about the head. It's down here compared to the head. That's conceptual. This awareness is boundless. Now there's a tactile sensation. Why does it seem like it's down?
That's where it is.
Relative to what, though?
This body, that Lahara, relative to harmony and center and balance, that's where your awareness really is.
But...
I mean, we could argue...
Down is a relative term, right? Down relative to what? Which something's, it sounds like there's something above it.
Down relative to what is the balanced center of any object?
Almost seems like it's all in the center. From the point of view of awareness, it's not one static point, right? And yet, the tactile sensations, where is there, again, we're being awareness. Now, we're not being aware of the body. This is the difference. Being aware of the body, it's down here, it's in the knee, it's in the... But now we're the spaceless awareness, like space, that has no location, helps to, I think, close the eyes, because the eyes create the sense of there's something down from the eyes. I think that's where what I'm calling conceptuality comes from. We feel a sensation in the stomach, and we're so used to then being able to visually see there's a body down here, and we connect the visual idea of the stomach being down from the eye. I think this is where the down is based on the eye. Because if you close your eyes, it's still trained, the awareness is still trained to think down. But now, it's not from the point of view of the eye organ. I mean, these are things to check out yourself in meditation. Is there a location to physical sensation or the body?
Really becomes useful and functional in terms of
We're not talking about head, though. This is maybe to end with this important point. This awareness has nothing at all to do with the head, although it's we tend to think that way. But that's why I'm saying, does it have any location? If we feel like the center of the awareness is in the head, that's not the awareness we're talking about. Or that's something to investigate. If it seems like it's in, why would it, does it seem like it's in the head or somehow connected with the brain or the sense organs? This awareness is boundless, so vast it fits into spaciousness, so vast it transcends dimension. And yet it's a knowing, but it's not mind or body, but it's modulated as mind and body. It's expressed as mind and body. And so I think this Tai Chi thing, to me it seems like that's the function of the laws of cause and effect in the dream. Yeah, being in this world, yeah. And using the so-called body and the world, and then we can be doing Tai Chi in this boundless awareness, but then, you know, but the awareness of the body, and even I was thinking about the subtle body that they talk more about in Tibetan Buddhism, that's almost a little different, like, than the gross body. Almost like I would still say it's still a modulation of the spaceless, space-like awareness. But it's like a bridge between the awareness and the tactile sensations of the body. It's not actually subtle. It's not the gross tactile sensations. It's like energy flow, right? Or chi. But still, yeah, strictly speaking, from the point of view of this awareness, it's still a reflection. The chi, I would understand, is still a reflection on the mirror. It's a half melted ice.
I know that my experience of duality is so strong that I think of me, and I could think of me without my hand. If my hand fell off my hand, mm-hmm. I'd still be me. I could even imagine, you know, if my stomach was somehow replaced, mm-hmm. I'd still be me.
Yeah.
I can't imagine me without my hand. You know, that's how strong it is. I mean, that's me. It's here, right? Somehow.
Yeah. So this is another. Yeah, and we have all ideas about the brain. Of course, in ancient India, they thought that the mind was located in the physical heart, and now science tells us other stories. But I think here, it's so many sense organs happen to have evolved in the same area. Interesting, they could have been like a mouth down here and an ear up here, you know. But interesting that they all clustered in this one area, and I think that helps to strongly create the delusion that I am somehow up here. But another one to investigate while resting as this awareness, you know, where are the edges, what's far and near, what's the investigate all the senses, is anything external to this awareness, and body and mind, and then the self, like who I think I am, I think is a really interesting one to investigate, because there's like, in a way, there seems to be the five skandhas self that's like all my karmic tendencies, body, mind, feelings, emotions, all of that is like, all you package all that together, five skandhas package, we say in Buddhism, is like, you know, this one particular ice cube in this awareness. It's not that awareness is me walking through the world, it's more like me is a kind of frozen chunk of water I think of as this limited somebody in the field of awareness that we all share. So investigating who is me here? And some traditions would say, the big I is this awareness, but that's different from little me that has hopes and dreams and all of that. awareness has no hopes and dreams.
I find the ice cube in this vast, limitless pool really useful.
Yeah, it's made out of water. The substance is not the slightest bit different, but it's congealed into what seems to be different. And you look at it like an iceberg floating in the ocean. Is that actually ocean? No, it looks like a separate ice cube, but on closer inspection, it's just part of the ocean frozen. Well then, on to more tactility. So, awareness can enjoy the day. And then, at the end, we'll release these crickets. Just to acknowledge, because it's so easy to look at an insect or something in this way of like, that's some little thing over there. But to feel like all sentient beings and all Buddhas are this one mind. Their awareness is like our awareness right now. They're over in the pet store still. But they're not the slightest bit separate from us. They're just like one bit of ice in this vast field, and we're one bit of ice. We're no difference at all. And therefore, why don't we free them? May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.